Back in the last century, I was an undergraduate student. And a popular comedian wrote a satirical course description for a philosophy class. Philosophy 1. Everyone from Plato to Camus is read, and the following topics are covered. Ethics, the categorical imperative, and 6 ways to make it work for you. Aesthetics. Is art the mirror of life, or what? Metaphysics. What happens to the soul after death? How does it manage? Epistemology. Is knowledge knowable? If not, how do we know this? The absurd. Why existence is often considered silly, particularly for men who wear brown and white shoes. Manyness and oneness are studied as they relate to otherness. Students achieving oneness will move ahead to two-ness. Those who successfully complete the introductory course could move on to the advanced course described as Philosophy 29B, Introduction to God, Confrontation with the Creator of the Universe through Informal Lectures and Field Trips. Now, I first read this satirical description when I was a 19-year-old student at Arizona State University. Socially awkward and still dealing with the death of my mother when I was 14, I had signed up for a class in existential philosophy. Most of the writings left me confused. However, the writings of one of the philosophers spoke to me in a deep personal way. He was the philosopher of relationships. I read everything he had written and everything that had been written about him. Martin Buber is my favorite philosopher. Buber was born in Vienna on February 8, 1878. 3 years later, his parents divorced, and his mother disappeared completely from the child's life. Martin moved to the home of his grandparents on his father's side. These grandparents told the small boy nothing about his parents' divorce. The 3-year-old child expected to see his mother again. When he was 4, a babysitter finally explained to him the facts of the situation. 80 years later, at the age of 84, Buber could still recall that moment. He wrote, "The house in which my grandmother lived in Vienna had a great rectangular inner courtyard surrounded by a wooden balcony extending to the roof on which one could walk around the building at each floor. We were both leaning on the railing. I cannot remember that I spoke of my mother to my older comrade, but I hear still how the big girl said to me, 'No, she will never come back.' I know that I remain silent, but also that I cherish no doubt of the truth of the spoken words. I suspect that all that I have learned about genuine meeting in the course of my life had its first origin in that hour on the balcony." As Buber was beginning to feel and understand the critical importance of relationships in human life, his grandparents were also immersing him in European languages and in Jewish culture. From his grandparents, he learned to speak and read not only his native German, but also Polish, French, Hebrew, and Latin. At the prayer house, he experienced the basic forms of religious community, rooted in common reverence and common joy. At the age of 14, Buber left his grandparents to live with his father and to enroll in high school in preparation for the university. Thus began a period of uprootedness and restlessness in his life. He found himself caught between the conservative traditions of his childhood and the liberal intellectual life he found in school. He wrote, "So long as I lived with my grandparents, my roots were firm. Soon after I left their house, the world of the age took me in. My spirit was in steady and multiple movement, in alternation of tension and release, determined by manifold influences, taking ever new shape, but without center and without a growing substance." When he was 15, Buber found himself terrified by the images of infinite space and time. The teenager tried to imagine space extending forever beyond our small planet. And he tried to imagine time as going back forever into the past and forever into the future. In his imagination, he saw himself as a tiny being caught up in a hostile and indifferent universe. He felt he was going mad, and in his depression, he considered the possibility of suicide. It was the study of the writings of the philosopher Immanuel Kant that saved the 15-year-old. Buber discovered a small volume by Kant with the modest title, A Prolegomena to Any Future Metaphysics That Will Ever Be Written. In the little book, Kant said, "What approaches us out of the world, hostile and terrifying, the mystery of space and time, is the mystery of our own comprehension of the world and the mystery of our own being. Space and time are not real," Kant said. "They are the forms in which we experience reality." And this has actually become the foundation for modern physics and understanding the nature of things. Space and time are the forms in which we experience reality. Buber took university classes in Vienna, in Leipzig, and in Berlin. When he was 19, his search for both a personal and religious identity led him to join the small but growing Zionist movement. The goal of the Zionists was to obtain a homeland for the Jews in the Middle East. For 5 years, Buber was an enthusiastic Zionist, caught up in the vision of a spiritual renewal among the Jewish people. However, in 1902, Buber became disillusioned with this Zionist political group. He felt that Zionism was primarily concerned with putting the needs of one group ahead of dedication to a universal truth and universal justice. In this same period, in the summer of 1899, Buber met a woman named Paula Winkler. She was a year older than he was and came from a Roman Catholic background. They were married in 1901 when Buber was 23. Paula converted to Judaism before the marriage. After he completed his schooling, Buber took on the role of a university professor in Berlin, teaching and lecturing in philosophy. Paula gave birth to two children. In his late 20s and early 30s, Buber's search for a personal and religious identity led him to become involved with emotional celebration of the Jewish religion. He began to enjoy what we would today call a spiritual emotional high. He became infatuated with feelings that come with the singing and the chanting, the praying and the meditating together in worship. He published a book about religious ecstasy, the feelings he was experiencing. In these moments of joy and ecstasy caught up in the singing and the chanting, the praying, the young university professor found what he took to be a oneness and a unity with God. However, in 1914, Buber's preoccupation with such emotional moments of religious excitement was decisively upset. After a morning of religious enthusiasm, the 36-year-old professor had office hours at the university, and he was visited by a student, a young man, who had sought him out for advice. The singing, the praying, the meditating Buber had just left was still on his mind. Therefore, he did not give the young man his full attention. Buber was friendly. He chatted openly with the young man. Still, he treated the conversation casually, without really fully being present. Shortly after the conversation, the young man committed suicide. That morning, before the young man's visit, the singing and the praying had filled Buber with a spiritual excitement, an emotional joy. He had felt himself in tune with eternity and with God. Because of this, he had not been fully present with the young man sitting before him in his office, who had come to him with serious questions about life and death. Later he wrote, "Since then, I have given up the religious, which is nothing but the exceptional, the exaltation, the ecstasy, or it has given me up. I possess nothing but the everyday out of which I am never taken. I know no fullness but each mortal hour's fullness of claim and responsibility. For me, this is what I mean by religion. Not removing yourself into another world, but responding to the call that comes into your everyday life. Above all, listening to both the silent and the spoken voices when one person speaks to another, so that together they can remove the barrier between two human beings." From this point on, Buber rejected vigorously all experience that encourages us to detach ourselves from day-to-day events. In 1922, he published a book that was to make him famous, in English translation, I and Thou. It is both a philosophical statement and a poem. I and Thou can be difficult to read in English, but its basic ideas are simple. Buber wrote that we humans have two types of relations, I-it relations and I-thou relations. A sales clerk in a store takes our money and gives us our purchase. We have had an I-it relationship. A small child screams in delight over the sight of a balloon. We look into the eyes of the parent of the child, and together we smile. For an instant, we share a silent understanding with this other person. We have had an I-thou relationship. We call on operator on the telephone to get a phone number of a friend who lives in another state. We've had an I-it relationship. We go to the hospital to visit a sick friend. We find our friend ill, and we sit and hold her hand, and we start to cry. A nurse stops making the bed and comes over, and she rests her hand on our arm for a moment. We have had an I-thou relationship. The car stops as we walk down the street, and the driver asks us for directions. We've had an I-it relationship. We're driving down the street one day, and we are suddenly aware of the beauty of a tree, so beautiful that we pull over and stop our car and just sit there in the driver's seat for a moment, and we look out at that beautiful tree. As we stand in the presence of nature, we feel a unity, a connection with the earth. We've had an I-thou relationship. Now, the use of the antiquated pronoun thou sounds strange to our ears. This strangeness is not intentional on Buber's part. He was writing in German. And the strangeness for us is a result of the limitations of translating from German into English. In Germany, close friends commonly use the pronoun du, D-U, to refer to lovers and to refer to children. Therefore, the original book, Ich Du, is not as formal or as unnatural as I Thou is in English. When we hear Buber's words in English translation, we should remember that he intended the word pair, I-thou, to suggest simple, unpretentious, familiar relationships. Buber writes that an I-thou relationship is mutual contact, the genuine reciprocal meeting of the fullness of life between one active existence and another. In contrast, an I-it relationship occurs whenever you treat a person or the earth as an object. Buber is not saying that I-it relationships are bad and that I-thou relationships are good. I-it relationships buying something at a store, getting directions, getting information. These are all necessary parts of life. Buber does say, however, that I-it relationships can never give our lives any sense of purpose, meaning, or unity. Only I-thou relationships give us this sense of wholeness. So he writes that I-it relationships establish the human situation, and I-thou relationships give meaning to the human situation. The fundamental choice we are free to make is to turn away or turn towards I-thou relationships. Buber believes that we meet the eternal thou in I-thou relationships. The wholeness we feel when we are in an I-thou relationship with another person or with the earth or with works of art, Buber calls the eternal thou. From 1922 onward, the fame of Martin Buber grew because of the popularity of his book, I and Thou. He gained respect from both Christians and Jews for his religious humanism. In the 1930s, Ronald Smith translated the book into English, and Buber's fame spread to the United States. In March of 1933, officials of the new Nazi government searched Buber's house. A national boycott against Jews began in Germany in April of 1933. And as part of the boycott, the Nazis required that all Jews place in their window a sign describing their profession. The Nazi official who came to Buber's house had no sign reading Jewish philosopher. Therefore, when he saw Buber's personal library of 20,000 books, he placed in Buber's window the sign Jewish book dealer. Local Nazis organized school children to stand outside Buber's house in the morning at 6 a.m. and sing a song called Only When a Jew's Blood Spurts from the Knife. In October of 1933, Buber resigned from his position as a professor in the German university system instead of waiting for an official dismissal. He told friends that he was determined to remain in Germany for as long as he could and devote his energy to Jewish education and culture. Before 1933, Buber's influence on German Jews had been profound but not widespread. After Hitler's rise to power, many found in his teachings what they needed to withstand the cruel demands of that time. Buber organized a network of teachers who gave comfort and education to other Jews, raising their spirits. In 1934, the Nazis banned Buber from teaching and speaking in public. For 4 years, a Quaker gave Buber the opportunity to continue his lectures in closed secret sessions. Finally, in 1938, after urgent appeals from friends, Buber left Germany for Jerusalem. In the years that followed, the generation of liberal religious Jews in Europe who had learned their philosophy from the lectures and writings of Martin Buber, that generation was destroyed. Orthodox Jews, conservative Orthodox Jews, and non-practicing secular Jews made up the Jewish community in Palestine. Both groups rejected Buber's liberal religious humanism. As a result, Buber found himself representing a minority position in his new home. After moving to Jerusalem, Buber began to criticize the new Jewish community in the Middle East for group egotism, for extreme nationalism, and for feelings of superiority. After the partition of Palestine in 1948, Buber became active in the Arab Jewish League. He supported the establishment of a government that would include both Jews and Arabs and would recognize Arab claims to land that Arabs had inhabited for centuries. Because of his belief in the sacredness of life, he found himself constantly at odds with the Israeli government. In 1961, at the age of 82, Buber was a lone voice in Israel protesting the execution of Eichmann. He said, "I do not accept the state's right to take the life of any person. And so I must resolutely oppose a capital sentence on anyone, whoever he is. I remember expressing myself in public against capital punishment in 1928 in Germany, and I cannot agree to it now that it would be my own people who would carry out the sentence in my own country. This is an issue of principle. It is more than a question of Eichmann and what I think of his horrible crimes. Anyone who thinks that I wish us to be lenient to Eichmann does not understand my basic position." Well, a student asks Buber, "What should be done with Eichmann if he is not executed?" Buber said, "He should be sentenced to life imprisonment. But we must remember always that he is a symbol of the Nazi Holocaust and not an ordinary criminal. So he should not be kept in a cell in a prison like other people under similar sentences. He should be made to feel that the Jewish people were not exterminated by the Nazis and that they live on here in Israel, Perhaps he should be put to work on the land, on a kibbutz, farming the soil of Israel, seeing young people around him, and realizing every day that we have survived his plans for us. Would this not be the ultimate and most fitting punishment? This is not easy, Buber said. There are problems of security, of vengeance. It is not a simple matter to sentence a man to life imprisonment, yet not lock him up. But I believe a way could be found. We should apply justice tempered with imagination. And this would serve a far greater moral and historical purpose than killing him. Well, for this statement, many Israelis strongly attacked Martin Buber. In April of 1965, Buber slipped in his bedroom and broke his leg. The 87-year-old man suffered considerable pain. From time to time, he lost consciousness. It was clear he was sinking and that his death was not far away. As he lay dying, the members of the Jerusalem City Council had a debate as to whether to give Buber a special award, an award they gave to honor important members of the community. Buber had lived in Jerusalem 27 years, yet he had never received any civic honor. Now, as he neared death, the council argued about whether to acknowledge his accomplishments. The debate was fierce and heated. The right-wing members of the council strongly opposed the recognition. They stated that Buber was not worthy of any honors because he had opposed Eichmann's execution. Local religious groups complained to the council that Buber was not an Orthodox Jew and did not attend a synagogue on a regular basis. Well, despite all this opposition, there was finally a slight majority in favor of the resolution. The mayor rushed to Buber's deathbed to inform him of the honor. A few days later, in June of 1965, Martin Buber died. Now, if today a dialogue, a conversation, has replaced the Cold War between the face of Christianity and the face of Judaism, I give some credit to Martin Buber. His book, I and Thou, has had an enormous impact on two generations of religious thinkers, Christian, Jewish, humanist. Buber looked for the underlying unity between people. He sought the common ground, always bringing people together on the narrow ridge of mutuality. He sought to humanize the world so that individuals would emerge out of a shapeless throng. It is a vision that has guided my own quest for a meaningful religion, free of exclusiveness, free of superiority. It demands that I look for meaning not in special emotional experiences, not in drugs, not in nationalism, not in power over others, but in relationships. Relationships of equality. In such relationships, moments of union, I-thou experiences, can occur at every hour of the day. If only I will open my heart and my mind, open my eyes and my ears. It is a vital vision that I find present in my ministry among you today.